Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.
Hello and welcome to the programme. Today, I travel to Portmore to witness the release of a pair of curlew, a bird that's sadly becoming very rare in Ireland. Dr. Richard Collins pops into the Natural History Museum in Dublin to find out about the latest renovations to be undertaken there. And Terry pays a visit to a Mooney listener in County Laois who's got some freeloading guests in her attic.
Now, Terry, just have a look up there behind you and you'll see where our lovely bats live.
Well, I don't see where they live, but I can see all that dirt on the wall. That's the guano.
Yes, it is. And there's plenty of guano because we have plenty of bats in our attic.
Now, you say plenty of bats. Are you talking about 5 or 10 or 15?
Well, the last count was 727.
Come on, I know what you're thinking. All those bats in the attic, but I put a question to you now. If you were given the choice of rodents or bats in the attic, which would you choose? I know I'd certainly choose the latter, but 727 bats. My house isn't big enough to support such a roost. We'll hear all about that story a little bit later on. And also, that very rare release of curlew in Portmore. Now, this is a bird that has declined on the island of Ireland. So we really got to watch out for this species. And what they did up in Portmore last Friday morning got a lot of media attention. The BBC were there, Associated Press were there, and of course I was there on behalf of Mooney Goes Wild on RTE Radio. It was a great endeavour and one that perhaps we need to consider doing more of in the future. But first, let's turn our attentions to the Natural History Museum in Dublin, also known as the Dead Zoo. I believe it's a buzz of activity at the moment because the roof of the museum, which was built in 1856, is now in need of essential renovation as part of a wider project to modernise the building. Two large whale skeletons are suspended from the ceiling. If you've been in, you'll know the ones I'm talking about. But before they can be removed, all of the exhibits below have to be dismantled. Now, many of these are being moved around for the first time in decades. To find out exactly what's going on, we sent Dr. Richard Collins in to the museum to have a chat with the curator, Paolo Viscardi.
Thank you, Derek. You should see the Natural History Museum today. It's unlike what it ever was before. On the first floor, it's not a bomb site by any means, but there's chaos. It consists of a whole row of huge wooden boxes and frames. And there's a team of people putting animals into wooden cages and then covering the wooden cages with plywood. I'm with Paolo Viscardi here and he will explain to us what is going on. Paolo.
Hi, Richard. Yeah, thanks for coming over today. It's always nice to show the space in a slightly different way to usual. So what we're doing is we're boxing in all of the old historic glass cases because we can't move them easily. They're huge, they're heavy, the glass is all plate glass. They are all protected, they're all listed. This is all part of the integrity of the building. So what we're doing is we're building boxes to protect them from any falling debris, things like nails and screws, and you never know what might fall off scaffolding. Now, ideally, nothing falls off the scaffolding, so that's why we have all the safety measures in place. But just in case, we're making sure that if anything does fall, it's not going to cause any damage to the cases. And then what we've done is we've boxed out some of the cases in such a high level you could park a car on it. It's really sturdy, really, really densely made. And we'll be using those as working platforms to access the smaller of our two whales, which has to come down first because it's hanging on chains through the larger of the two. So the humpback whale is a juvenile. It's fairly small. It's only about a ton in weight, maybe a little bit less. And so that's going to be the first thing which we take apart. And then we'll be moving on to the big fin whale, which is hanging above it. The second biggest animal in the world. It's 20 metres long. It's heavy and it's a skeleton. But those bones are very dense. So that's going to be a more complicated job. So we'll get rid of the humpback out of the way first, take that off to our offsite stores, and then we'll be building in a fixed scaffold underneath the fin whale, which we'll be using as a working platform to take down the fin whale. And we've got specialists who have to come over to do this work because it's very, very difficult, very detailed. They're heavy things hanging from height. They're quite fragile as well. You might think a whale bone as being, you know, it's dense and heavy. You know, the lower jaw on the fin whale, for example, just one half of it is about 180 kilos. It's a heavy lump of bone. But there are other things that may have gone into that. That was washed up in, it was stranded in 1862. And it was put up on the roof over 100 years ago. We have no idea how they did it. You know, we didn't get a manual with it or anything like that. There's no Haynes manual that comes with this particular specimen of whale. So we don't know what things they've put in there. There might be bits of timber. There's definitely some plaster in there. We're pretty sure there's timber as well. And all that it takes to go wrong is for us to not understand how it goes together and for someone to make a stupid mistake in loosening a bolt when they shouldn't be, and the whole thing collapses and you've got a ton falling on the floor. That's why we need specialists, people who have done this before in other museums with the same sort of whale. And so the guys we've got coming over have that experience, and we're looking forward to working with them to get the specimens down safely and out so that we can get started on that roof.
Paulo, as you dismantle some of these things, and they have been lying around for 150 years, you must find strange things. What are the ones that stand out, the strange things you've discovered?
There are so many odd things that we've found so far. There are two main sorts of weird stuff. One is the rubbish that people have been throwing into specimens. So, for example, the elephant that I moved this morning, the elephant skeleton, the back of its skull has a big hole in it where they made a space to go in to fasten up bolts on the inside of the armature. And members of the public from back in the day had been walking around on the balcony throwing their rubbish into it and using it as a little kind of wishing well type thing. So there were coins in there. There were old bus tickets. There was a piece of mummified fruit. All sort of like an apple which had gone absolutely rock hard. It was petrified. So, you know, that's one of the sorts of things. But the weirdest things have actually been bits and bobs that staff have hidden away in the past in the spaces. So we've found shoes. We found old civil service standard toilet roll. The weirdest thing I think we found so far has been a plug-in electric double hob in its box. I would say brand spanking new, but it's probably from the 1980s, but it is unused and, you know, still shiny. And that was under the rhinoceros skeleton. So you never quite know what you'll find where in this place. It's an unusual environment and you can't predict anything. In some ways that's exciting, in other ways it's a real pain in the neck.
Paulo, this is all about the roof. Now, one thing I love about this building, and it's a very attractive building, is the wonderful light you have in here. And the reason is that, of course, it is a glass roof, and the light comes down from above. I sincerely hope, you're not going to turn it into a closed-off thing with no light coming in from the top, are you?
I wish I had control of that. That's down to the architects. I doubt it, because at the end of the day, it's a historic building. So I expect we'll end up just having the roof largely replaced, pretty much the same as it is, but obviously in a much better condition. Personally, I would love to have all natural light cut out of this building. What we find is with the daylight that comes in during the summer, it means that it can be very, very bright in here. It can get very hot. It acts like a greenhouse in here. And obviously, with a building this old, we don't have things like air conditioning. There's not the right kind of structure for the building to have that kind of plant in place and working properly. So it gets very hot in here. It's really bad for the objects. There's also all the light streaming in, which is bleaching all the objects. So when you come in and you look at some of the specimens, you're not sure whether it's an albino or if it's in its natural colour just because it's been faded. A lot of the specimens have been damaged by the light because they've been, you know, on display for over 100 years with daylight streaming in on them. And we can filter out things like the ultraviolet end of that light because, you know, that's the most damaging part. And we have film on the windows and the ceiling and all the rest of it. But it's not just the ultraviolet. All light is damaging to, especially things like fur and feathers. It's really good at removing the colour from those sorts of materials. So I'd be delighted to cut out the natural light. And also, it means that in the winter, when it's dark outside and you've got heavy rain clouds, it's pitch dark in here. You can barely see anything. So that kind of detracts from the overall experience of a visit for people as well. So I'd be really keen to see steps taken to try to kind of minimise the problems and maximise the benefits.
Now, the logistics of taking down the two big whale skeletons, are you going to leave them here on top of these boxes that are here and cover them in another box? Or are you going to take them apart and take them out the door? How is that going to be handled?
Well, we're not going to get them out the door. They're too big for the door. So, but we're not leaving them in the building. So what we're going to be doing is taking them down, building transport frames for them, which will have wheels and all the rest of it. And they will basically be driven out the side of the wall. We're removing a window and the surrounding brickwork in order to create an opening, which will obviously all be put back in again afterwards. We're not leaving it as a gaping hole in the side of the building. It'll all be done, you know, very sensitively. Everything in this building is done with a huge amount of respect for the building. It went up in 1856, opened in 1857. It's a fantastic environment, beautiful space. So we need to keep the feel of the place, and we certainly don't want to lose that. So we're not going to be creating additional holes in things unnecessarily.
Of course, this is not just a museum, it's a museum of a museum. Now, that is not a disparaging remark by any means, because it has this wonderful atmosphere. It shows you what a museum was like 200 years ago almost now. I mean, that is an extraordinary exhibit in its own right. And if you modernise it and put in all kinds of digital gizmos and buttons for the children to press, the whole thing will be different. And I wouldn't think, looking at museums abroad that have done this, I would much prefer the old-style museum. And places like Paris, for instance, the museum there is old-style. You've got all the skeletons in a big room. The same in Berlin to some extent, but others have gone for all sorts of dioramas and fancy gizmos and things. And I think it's a loss to do that. Are you going? You have this tension between modernity and antiquity. How do you solve that?
I 100% agree with you, Richard. We do not want to change the feel of this place at all. The feel of the place is part of what it is. It's what makes it the Dead Zoo. It's what makes it a special place. It's why I love it. You know, I went away and worked in museums in London for 10 years after starting my career in this museum. And I came back. And I came back because I fell in love with it the moment I walked in the door. It's a wonderful place. And certainly I would be heartbroken if that were to change. I want this place to continue to feel as it feels. But I also want to make sure that those bits which need to be modernised, and by modernised I don't mean in a kind of push buttons and horrible, you know, kind of shiny glass everywhere kind of way. I mean in a making it safe for people. You know, we're currently standing on a balcony which has been closed to the public for over 10 years now. And that's simply because it was never built for the numbers of people that we're talking about, well, that we get through the doors today. And we don't have the emergency exits needed to be able to evacuate the building if there was ever a problem. All of those sorts of things, well, certainly not these balconies anyway. We can do it from the ground floor and from the first floor, but we can't do it from the balconies. So ideally what we will do is make these sorts of spaces fit for purpose, fit for a modern purpose, you know, which is basically serving the same purpose that they currently would serve, except in a safe way. Which basically means bringing up a barrier so it's a little bit higher, so you can't just fall over it. You know, I can sit on this rail here without bending my knee. In fact, I have to bend my knees to get down to it. That's not ideal. You don't want that, because if I were to trip and hit that, I'd go straight over. And those are the sorts of things which are fine when you're building a museum in 1856, but in 2020, you just can't get away with that kind of thing, which is why we don't have this space open. Or not the only reason, because people say, why don't you just build the barrier a bit higher? But if you do that, it adds more weight to the outside of the balcony. And our structural engineers have looked at the way in which the balcony is suspended and supported, and it's not strong enough to add the extra weight and have people walking on it. So we could make the barrier higher, but you wouldn't then be able to walk on it because it would be too weak.
Well, if you haven't been to the Natural History Museum, it's a bit like a prison. You know, the sort of walkways they have around a central atrium in a prison. Well, you have that here. And it's these balconies that surround the main atrium where the exhibits are down below. That is what we're talking about. Now, when my children, the three sons, were young, we used to come up here and we used to look at things like the Blaska models, which were exquisite things. They're a gem of this museum. You have a superb collection of Blaska models. The Blaska father and son, actually, from Dresden. Now, my grandchildren have never been up there because of all these health and safety things that have come in, you know. Is there a plan to do something with this walkway and try to... It shouldn't be beyond the 21st century engineering world to construct something safe up here.
Well, that's certainly the plan, Richard. We really want to be able to open up all the spaces in this museum. You know, we are here for the public. This is our public's face. You know, we have 10,000 objects here for people to see, including the Blaskas, and we want people to be able to come and see them. The big problem is, obviously, as I've said, the building is not really very well suited to a modern audience in terms of safety. So one of the things that we really want to, and this won't be part of the roof project, which is just a discrete project which is happening, has to happen first, because if we don't have a waterproof building, we don't have anything to work with. You know, first rule of any kind of building work, you make the site waterproof, and we're not yet waterproof. We're getting there, and once the roof is fixed, we will be there, but until then, we can't really think about much else. So in the background, we've got a lot of planning going on, putting together business case and all the rest of it for doing a much bigger redevelopment in the space. And we certainly know that there's interest and an intent to try to push that forward. It's what part of the museum's kind of long-term plan to get a full redevelopment of this space. So, you know, all of these things are in train, and certainly it's what we want to happen. And, you know, I think generally most people do want that to happen. I don't think anyone's against it. But of course, in the current climate with COVID and the likely impact that's going to have on economy and so on, there are no guarantees. You know, it's going to take a bit of money to get this building fit for people to use. We just don't know where that's, well, we've got an idea of where we want it to come from, but we don't know whether it will be there just because of the current situation. And, you know, no one knows. It's one of those situations at the moment. Everyone's living in a state of uncertainty to a large extent, which is part of what makes this whole situation so difficult for many people.
Paolo Viscardi, curator of the Natural History Museum in Dublin, speaking with our own Dr. Richard Collins. Now, the curlew population in Ireland has declined, it is believed, by 80 to 96%, depending on which part of the country you're in, more so than anywhere else in Europe. So you can imagine how thrilled I was to get a tip off that two birds, which were given a head start, were about to be released at the RSPB Portmore Loch Nature Reserve in County Antrim. And it was to there I headed last Friday morning to catch up with an old friend of Mooney Goes Wild, Dr. Kendrew Colquhoun. Kendrew, what's going on here today?
We are a very exciting day because the culmination of about two months' work, whereby we are going to check our wee birds are okay, the two curlews, and we're going to release them into the big wide world for the first time. We want to do it an early part of the day because it obviously gives them lots of daylight to reacquaint themselves to the big wide world, and we were just waiting for a reasonable weather window, and thankfully that rain has stopped.
Yeah, still quite mucky.
Oh, totally, but you know, if there's a curlew, great. Yeah. You know, they need soft soil, and these birds have been in this what size is it, about 60 square metre pen for about 3 weeks. So they've obviously been, as well as getting fed by us special food, they're obviously picking around it and vertebrates on the surface. And then, so this is all part of their training too.
Yeah. So tell me exactly where we are.
Mid-east side of Lough Neagh.
And tell me about the curlew here.
Curlew used to be here as a breeding species at this site, and we know that this area that we're releasing these birds in is part of the leased land by RSPB, where they have plans afoot to get the habitat into condition specifically for curlew. Obviously they've got lapwing and so on here, and this is one of the reasons why we are here. But the birds are hanging on by a thread. They're gone from most of the rest of the country.
Yeah. That, why?
You know, the massive changes caused by us, primarily, you know, drainage. We're saying this is great and mucky here. Well, that's one of the reasons why curlew are kind of holding on in some of these areas, is because they're wet. And obviously wet means you have difficulty in farming it intensively as well, which of course is conducive to curlew. So the main driver of declines is undoubtedly, you know, landscape change. In Ireland, that's, you know, removal of peat land for fuel and for horticultural use. It is afforestation of, you know, curlews don't breed in forests, that loss of open landscape that they need. And the other big thing is, of course, intensification of farming in farmed areas, so drainage and the associated intensification of grassland, you know, multiple mowing, the same sort of things that have affected corncrakes. There are some similarities, some differences between corncrakes and curlew. They're both, unfortunately, in that category of under severe threat. And a lot of the same types of drivers, they're both ground nesting. They both like cover to some extent, and they're both really at the mercy of agriculture intensive case, which isn't the farmer's fault. It's all our fault. It's our demand for meat, for milk, cap. It's all of these big drivers that influence what people do on the ground. And unfortunately, that has had a real growing impact for now 3 or 4 decades. And that's why we are where we are. I should also say that because of the declines and the birds are at a very low ebb at the minute, the predation pressure on ground nesting birds which is a sensitive subject, but the predation pressure in those is magnified. So a bird like a curlew that lives for 20, 30 years, maybe only needs to breed in a normal healthy population. It maybe only needs to breed successfully every half dozen years or something like that. That's the way they've evolved.
And how many eggs do they lay?
Around four.
And how many would they get off?
Well,
how many would actually fledge?
You know, these birds are, I suppose, artificially fledging that we're going to look at today.
Mm.
But the number of those that are fledging in the wild is minuscule. So little that that's why we're in the predicament we're in. That's why there are so few birds, because those are obviously the future breeders. There's no question that egg predation is a major problem, as is chick predation. And not wanting to hammer the predators too much.
Well, who are the culprits, yeah?
The culprits are crows and foxes. Any ground nesting bird is extremely vulnerable, of course, but they're not so vulnerable when there are lots of these birds breeding. So this is why I say that it's magnified. You know, we have these birds are at a very low population level, and they can, in normal circumstances, sustain, you know, predation levels. That's the way the ecology works.
Mm-hmm.
But not whenever they're on their knees. So they're no different to lapwing. You know, their nests are, you know, they're exposed, they're vulnerable, and definitely predator numbers are up. Barry McMahon has published recently a paper in Journal of Applied Ecology talking about ground nesting birds and their population.
We had him on the radio program,
Europe.
We were discussing it, and the problem with predation, and it's something he says that people don't want to discuss.
Absolutely.
Everybody gets very nervous around this subject of you must control predators in order to conserve species.
Yeah, people don't want to discuss it. That's logical, but I'm afraid we've just got to wake up, because I have a healthy respect for foxes, don't get me wrong. But, you know, foxes are super abundant, and I'm afraid of tough choices have got to be made. I have no hesitation, based on evidence, scientific evidence, on recommending that such interventions are absolutely necessary, because we're in the situation whereby we have to decide, do we control and manage an artificially high population? Because when I say artificial, that's because we are creating food for foxes in cities and the rural environment. Or do we want to lose something that is demonstrably been hugely impacted by these birds? It's a tough choice, but we've got to be realistic. We have to be realistic with lots of things. You've got to make tough choices, and you've got to decide what you want. And I'm afraid that management of predators has to be part of that. If we don't manage predators, then we won't get enough young curlew off. The sort of work that we're doing here isn't it's done as a crisis measure. It isn't for us to artificially raise birds to release into the wild. That is being done in other places. That's pretty drastic measure, if you ask me, for, you know, when a species is in that situation, that we have to resort to that level of intervention. Ideally, you would help the birds help themselves, rather than you would actually artificially rear their young. That's extreme.
Okay, well, we'll talk about exactly what you did here when the rest of the media arrive, because this is a bit of a media circus today, isn't it?
Yeah, it's going to be crazy. Just got all sorts of people.
Just explain what's going to happen.
Now, as we will walk down to the pen, that's the first time that some of the people here today
will have seen the pen. Explain.
The pen. Well, it's not something that NASA would have produced now. It is something that is made from timber and wire.
Mm.
It is roughly the size of, let's say, your average, about maybe 5 to 10 times your average garden shed. Sort of thing you'd put chickens in if you wanted a sort of bit of bling for your chickens. So it's about 8 foot high. It's about 8 meters on each square, so 8 meters on each side. And the only bit that's closed off is the bottom 2 foot, which is solid boarding. What we have to be very careful of about birds in this sort of artificial situation is, of course, they're very curious. They pick up all sorts of things. So foreign objects like a staple or a nail or something, they could hurt themselves on, for sure. Could kill them. And also, of course, you know, these birds aren't designed to be inside a wire structure. So we've got soft netting above, so they can, you know, if when they're learning to fly and they're strengthening their wings and so on, they're not going to injure themselves. And also, when the entire lining is soft wire. On the outside, of course, on the other side of the fence, so to speak, which is why they're in the fence, we're keeping Mr. Fox out. So on the outside, we've got chicken wire from floor to ceiling. And then we've got an Alcatraz type of triple lock security system. Not terribly sophisticated, but it's just electrified. It's got, you know, just normal agricultural electric fencing, but you'll probably be quite impressed. You'll see how much work goes into this, whereby we have to keep out everything that could eat a baby curlew, from a mink to a crow and everything in between, whether they've got four legs or two. So that's and then we have three levels. We've got an outer layer to keep the cows out because the cows are in the same field. Then we've got an interior which is multi-strand, which is to keep Mr. Fox out. And those are the sorts of fences are put these days, increasingly so, around real nests of real curlew in various parts, such as the CCP project, which is to obviously doesn't keep your flying predator out, but it keeps badgers, foxes, and other mammalian predators out. Because they walk up, they touch the electric fence. So it's got multiple strands.
Yeah. It doesn't kill them; it just gives them a little shock.
Absolutely,
and off they go.
Exactly, they walk off, and maybe there's something in behind that, but we'll just leave it.
So you're going to release how many curlew today?
Two. In the southwest corner of Lough Neagh, the Lough Neagh Partnership have a project running on landscape restoration, which curlew emerged, to our surprise, as a really important species. The last breeding pairs in the whole Lough Neagh Basin currently are in this area of southwest Lough Neagh. It's a little distant from here, and we've been working now for two summers researching those birds. So we're GPS tracking them, we're looking at their nesting success, we're looking at reasons for failures of nests and so on. And that's kind of where this is. This hasn't been by design, this has been a kind of emergency measure. In the course of that work, where we've actually had to make a very tough decision, can we sit back and watch these birds potentially perish?
You say emergency measure, what happened exactly? And what did you do, more importantly?
So we were doing a research in a section of bogland, state-owned bogland. We had predator fence around the first nest, and there was so much burning of the bog going on almost daily. And of course, the bogs can self-ignite after, you know, they don't really go out. It takes weeks for them to go out. That very dry spell we had in the spring across Ireland, there was bog burning going on, and we basically had to take a decision with advice from the Environment Agency, from Fire Service in Northern Ireland, that the acute risk to the bog going up was such that we couldn't not do anything. We had to, can we sit back and see this nest disappear, or what?
And the adults can fly away, the eggs are stuck there.
Totally perished, and potentially the adults, who knows, they might sit to the last minute, they might get burned. Fire
course,
risk. Yeah. So we ended up having to make a tough decision, and we got ourselves organised in terms of the facility we'd have to have, the incubators, the levels of hygiene, a storage mechanism to transport them.
How did you do it? How did you take them up? Did you wear gloves, special gloves, PPE? What kind of incubator did you use? Where was it? How long did you keep the eggs in there for, etc., etc.?
We had to quickly put together a appropriate transportation mechanism. I can't remember the detail, but it was fairly unsophisticated. You know, padded, things that are padded, putting the right things in the right part of the car, etc. Had to be done very quickly and all lined up. So what we did was we got all that organised, we went out, we lifted the eggs, we already had measured egg density so we knew when they were likely to hatch, and we had all our facilities set up in rapid time, aided, I have to say, by the fact that Kerry, who works with me on the project, is a trained agriculturalist, so, you know, hatching eggs is something that he totally knows about.
Okay. So,
you know, fair credit to Kerry. Those eggs needed constant attention. The incubators automatically roll the egg. The stuff that that a wild bird does innately. Humans obviously have learned to do this stuff. Wildfire Wetlands Trust and across the water are experts at this. In fact, in raising curlew chicks, they've really cracked it. And we had already got a lot of information for them prior to this on what would be required. So we had a kind of head start on what were the essential components to take it from the stage in the field to this stage.
Okay, where we are today. So
yes.
How many eggs did you take?
We took one clutch of four eggs.
Yeah.
And then within a week, we discovered another clutch of eggs in the same bog, about 400 yards away, so facing the same threat. So we again consulted and we were told we could lift them as well.
So how many in total?
Eight eggs.
And how many hatched?
So we had three hatched eggs from both clutches. So there's one inviable egg in each clutch. So we had three surviving chicks in each clutch. At the first stage, by the way, is another smaller pen.
Yeah.
That is at
But you have to hand rear those.
Practically, although what they've got to be very careful, you hand-read them, yes, but they've got to be very careful about not getting them by tutoring people.
So you don't imprint on them. Exactly. Of course, you keep a separation, but you have to rear them anyway, you have to feed them. So you had six now, six chicks,
yes.
Curlew chicks?
Yes.
And how many had survived? You'd already released
five.
Them. That's fantastic.
Well, so, compared to the wild situation, Derek,
so
it is
you've already pre-released how many?
Three.
Three, so two today.
Two today, and that's the full complement.
And how old are they now?
They're about, good question. There must be about 40, 45 days, something like that.
Well, this is very exciting. I'm really looking forward to this. Shall we get on with it?
Absolutely.
As a conservation scientist, Kendru believes there was no other option but to intervene. They simply couldn't be bystanders to the acute threat of burning. But it couldn't have been undertaken without the support of the Loch Ness Partnership.
My name is Siobhan Thompson and I work for the Loch Ness Partnership. They're an organisation which carries out conservation and cultural work around the loch. So my role as Natural Heritage Officer is to deal with the natural heritage projects, one of which is the Save in Nature project, which is based at a site in the southwest of Loch Ness. So it's a large area of cut over bog, essentially, and we've been working on it now for about 4 years, looking at it in terms of restoring the bog and carrying out some practical tasks that will help to restore it to what it was and increase its ability to sequester carbon for climate change, etc., etc. But while we were working on it during the first year, we realised that we actually had breeding pairs of curlew, which was really significant. So we were really excited to see these birds, and it's an ideal kind of landscape for them. You have large expanses of cut-over bog, you have large areas of wetland because you're right beside the Loch Ness Basin, and it's in a really kind of intimate community area where local people are very interested in the natural heritage and are keen to kind of help. So we'd been working on the kind of cultural stuff, and then we realised the birds were there and we wanted to do something to help with their restoration and their conservation. So we put out essentially a tender for works to bring in a couple of experts. So Dr. Kendru Culhoun and Kerry Mackey came on board with the project, and it's been fantastic. We've had 3 years of monitoring the population down in that southwest area. It's a little remnant population, but it's really significant in terms of providing connectivity between those outlying populations that exist across Northern Ireland. So we've been monitoring, you know, seeing when they come in to breed, etc., etc. This year we faced an additional challenge in that we had wildfires on the site. We were monitoring the eggs and the nests, and we were monitoring the fire situation, and we could see the fires getting closer to the nests, and we knew that potentially we could be in a situation where we had loss, we could lose the nests and the eggs. These birds are very vulnerable, and we took the decision to apply to NIEA, who are the licensing body, the Environment Agency in Northern Ireland. In a first for Ireland, we applied to them for a license to remove the eggs from the nest, and we got that. We set up incubators, moved very, very quickly once we had the permissions, set up incubators, lifted two nests that were in danger and got them into the incubators. They spent the necessary time, 6 weeks, 7 weeks in the incubators, hatched, and then these birds have been basically in the pens for approximately 7 weeks. So we did a release 2 weeks ago with three birds that were at a more advanced stage, and these birds then were the smaller and slightly younger, and we are now today ready to release them. So they're able to fly, they're taken off, they're able to kind of maneuver within the pen. So we're quite excited to see what happens, and it's really exciting to see these birds going back out into the Loch Ness landscape. And we hope that they sort of come back and form part of that breeding wader core that is going to be around the loch in the years to come. So really significant input, I think, in terms of conservation and benefits to the curlew population in the area. We are working, obviously, in the immediate situation with these birds around the Loch Ness. But strategically, we're working in terms of peatland restoration with other organisations, and we're voicing our desire that there's a strategic restoration of peatlands. I'd heard a figure, actually, I'm not sure if it was the IPCC down south came up with it or who it was, but there was a figure recently that if we were restoring all our Irish bogs to the level that we needed to restore them, we would reduce the amount of carbon being released into our atmosphere by the same amount that's released by the Irish transport system.
Really? Okay.
So a massive,
well, bogs are a very good carbon sink, aren't they?
They're a very good carbon sink, but when they are in bad condition, they actually release carbon out into the atmosphere. So they're acting as, you know, the opposite of carbon sequestration. They're actually releasing. So I think the sooner, you know, strategically our governments get together and work on that kind of peatland restoration across the whole island of Ireland, you know, you're going to see significant benefits for species such as curlew. And I mean, who wouldn't want that?
We're up at this pen, Derek. This is this 8x8 metre pen, and we are now dismantling. It's a square. It's made up of four sides, as squares tend to be, and we are now dismantling the panel so that we're going to move this panel, and this 4 metre wide gap is the one that the birds will walk, slide or fly out of. We just have to see what they're going to do, but I think they're going to fly because there's a lot of wind today. They fly into the wind, and that is our big moment. You only get one take at this, of course.
They look like they're itching to go.
Definitely, they're. You can see they're fit and healthy. They've got an individually engraved colour rings. So all of the five birds, Derek, that we're releasing have these stripe rings on one leg. So that's their absolute identifier that they're captive reared birds of these curlews. So, you know, it has to be an approved scheme. And then they've got an individually lettered ring on the other leg, which is unique to the individual. And then that means that whenever these birds are observed by the public, it could be in Donegal, it could be in County Down, it could be in Sweden, wherever, we will be able to monitor their movements. And, you know, it would be amazing that if we can follow up in the next few months and years, that where our birds, and obviously that's how we'll know if these birds are coming back here to breed, which is the ultimate aim.
Now, do you know if they're male or female?
Don't know. We will know when they're bigger, because by size and by their bill length, we will know. Female curlews, much, much bigger, noticeably bigger bird, and noticeably longer bill. So we can't tell that for now.
With the enclosure partly dismantled, it wasn't long before the first brave curlew stepped outside and took its first flight to freedom. And to the delight of a few key project members and invited press, it was soon followed by its remaining sibling.
Wow.
Well, you never quite know what they're going to do. Of course, they're going to fly. I think I was saying they're going to fly. Not difficult to guess that when they're two birds and they're ready to fly, but there was a bit of hesitancy. The first bird went through, wind caught it,
straight
up. The second bird thought this, they've been so used to walking up and down the fence like chickens that they
the barrier was still there, an invisible barrier.
Exactly, he's walking up and not, what's going on here? So I went in and gave it a wee bit of encouragement to kind of follow the path of its sibling, and it did the same, it just did a bit slower.
Yeah, but you could see how healthy they are. I mean, they took to the air straight away. And they both called when they took to the wing.
Yeah,
pretty cool. Why do they do that, do you know?
Pretty cool.
Any particular reason?
I don't know. I think, part of it is...
freedom!
Well, kind of. And the birds very often do that as a kind of alarm because, you know, they're all of a sudden they're being scared. I mean, they have called here a little bit when we're in feeding them, particularly when they fly. I think it must be an automatic thing when they fly. One bird's gone kind of northwest there and it's landed. We've seen it a few times. Another bird went northeast. It'd be nice had they gone exactly together, but I'm sure they'll, again, contact calls, they'll call to each other. I'm sure they'll be back.
Well, you must be full of joy now because these birds have got off successfully. Out of 8 eggs, you've managed to successfully release 5.
Five chicks flying from 6 chicks that hatched.
That hatched, yeah.
And that's a remarkable
Absolutely.
Percentage. Particularly given what would happen regrettably in the wild situation now, Derek. So, no, chuffed, dead chuffed. Yeah. That's another bird that needs a bit of care and attention, our chuffs. But, you know, we're dead pleased that what we've done this. And, you know, it's been a hell of a lot of work, particularly for my colleague, Kerry, who really has masterminded and been meticulous to do this. You know, it's like raising a family. He has done this mostly single-handedly with a small team around him that has helped. And it's really
rewarding. A first for Ireland, a first for curlew.
first for curlew in Ireland, absolutely. And, yeah. and you know, at least, you know, we've done this for we've done this as an exercise, a kind of emergency measure, as discussed. But, you know, elsewhere, this is being done in a premeditated way to help curlew. Mm. So at least arising from this, we have learned a lot. We know what's needed. We know the effort required. We know what to do, what not to do. And we should all go through life learning from what we've done before and adapting and so on. So, you know, at least we know that, because I regret to say it, it's a very high level of intervention for any animal, but I regret to say that I think that the future of curlew is so bleak that this sort of thing might, in a predetermined way, i.e. we decide we will lift eggs to hatch rather than we do it as an emergency response, might have to become a much commoner thing.
Well, well done. Congratulations to everybody involved.
Thank you very much, Derek. We're dead pleased.
And you can see the video of those two curlew taking flight on our website, which is rte.ie/Mooney. Now, we received an email to the programme recently from a listener who bought a house in County Laois 3 years ago, only to discover that they had quite a number of uninvited guests roosting in their attic. Terry Flanagan has more on this story. Terry.
Yes, Derek, we had a very interesting email in from a listener regarding bats. Kerry McLean Redmond and her husband Shane moved into a new house, a bungalow, in the parish of Camross 3 years ago. Now, what they didn't know when they moved in was there were already occupants in the house, a colony of nursing bats, and they've been there for the 3 summers since. Now, both Kerry and Shane love nature and wildlife, and they understand that bats are a protected species, but they want to know, is there anything they can do with this roost in their attic? So last week, I headed off to County Laois to meet them.
Now, Terry, just have a look up there behind you and you'll see where our lovely bats live.
Well, I don't see where they live, but I can see all that dirt on the wall. That's the guano.
Yes, it is. And there's plenty of guano because we have plenty of bats in our attic.
Now, you say plenty of bats. You're talking about 5 or 10 or 15?
Well, the last count was 727.
727 bats in this house.
Correct and right. 727 bats in our attic.
How did you manage to count that number?
With a lot of patience, and we sat at different points of the house and we all had a job to count them. But I suppose what's helpful is the bats come out in threes, so you can kind
they come out in threes.
They seem to come out in threes. That's what we've noticed over the last few years, is that they come out in threes and it's kind of easier to count them in that way then, do you know?
And how long would it take them to get out?
Oh, that's maybe about an hour and a half, would it, Shay?
Yeah, about an hour and a half.
And do you think this is a maternity roost, you said?
Yeah. We do believe so, because we've done some reading and research into bats. And as I said, when chatting to you earlier, our first year here, when we moved in 2017, we counted maybe about 250-ish mm-hmm. bats. And then the following year, there was touching 400. And this year, there was less coming. And by the end of August, there was more leaving.
Right.
So when we did some research and kind of looked up things, it was observed that it would be a maternity roost here.
Now, they've all gone.
They've all gone. Our last evening, I suppose, that we looked at them would have been maybe around the 10th of August, thereabouts. Mm-hmm. But they usually come, when do they come, Shay? Probably the end of June, is
June,
it?
June, you'd have them in June and be gone around.
They're all of July. And around the first or second week in August, they're usually gone. But I think this year they went earlier because the weather was so bad. It wasn't great weather. Like when it's warmer, they stay longer.
Now, when they leave the house every night, what do they do? Do they hang around the area? Because looking around you, you're surrounded by woodland, but you have a lovely open part here in the garden.
Thank you, we do. So usually when they come out from the gable end, they will go for those trees there, mm-hmm. right behind you. And the bats that come from the chimneys usually go across the road to the trees across the road. And the bats that come from the far chimney will go over to our far left here, to where the sort of the bog and the other end of the forest is.
So your bungalow here has openings, so to speak, on three sides.
Correct.
And then what time do they come back at?
About 5 o'clock, would it be?
If I come out at night time, bring out the dogs before, you know, you come around here and you light, turn on that light there. You can see them. Over and back the whole time.
So they're staying in the
area? No, they're staying in the area. They're here from the time they come out, they're staying in the area. They're over and back. And about a week before they left, it was at night time here, it was covered with bats.
So it must have been a beautiful sight.
It is. From a nature point of view, it is.
I know, but there's a but coming.
There is a but. Our big but, I suppose, is, you know, we do want to preserve, and we are, as you can see where we live in the middle of nature. We love nature. We have squirrels in our garden, red squirrels.
Red squirrels.
We have two families of red squirrels down at the bottom of the garden in the trees down there. There's hedgehogs, there's pine martens, there's stoats, there's deer, a deer track at the bottom of our garden into this fallow deer there in the forest behind us, and they have a foot track all the way at the back of the garden.
So you are keen on nature, that's the first
thing. Oh, we are very much so on gardening. We'd be very outdoor people,
But let's go back to the bush.
So the bush is the smell of the bats within the house. In particular, as Shay said, at the gable end of the house, there's two bedrooms under it and a bathroom, and when they're here, you can't open the windows in the evening because they'd come into the house. We'd have bats. We've had bats in multiple times in the house. And we'd take them out very carefully with a towel, and you'd never harm them naturally. But it's the smell is very, very rancid. And I suppose our attic is just destroyed with bat guana. We can store nothing in the attic at all. Right. And as I said, we've only moved into the house a couple of years ago, and we do want to do some work and insulate the attic. So that's why we want to have conversation with the National Park and Wildlife Service around permission and, I suppose, getting license to do that and to get advice on what we do. Because my husband is a carpenter as well, and he would make bat boxes till they come out of his ears. So we've no problem with them staying on the property. We just don't want them in our attic.
Mm-hmm. Well, they are very good. I mean, people have this opinion that bats, they for instance, get caught in your hair.
Oh, not at all.
Not at all.
Not at all. They wouldn't harm or hurt you at all. Not at all. No. They might like tip into, you'd be sitting in the sitting room watching telly. Mm. And the other week my daughter said, "Oh, Mammy, look, there's a bat crawling across the floor." So you just get up and you get the bat and you take it out and put it in, you know, up near a tree, and they're grand.
Yeah. People say they're mice with wings.
Not at all. They're tiny.
Yeah.
Like, people think they're big, but they're not. They're teensy tiny, aren't they, Shay?
Yeah, I think you're probably pipistrelles is what
yes,
you have.
Yes, it is what we have, you know, but they're tiny little bats. Now,
and people have this opinion too, or some people would have this opinion, that they suck blood. They don't actually
not
suck
at
your blood.
At all, no. Yeah. No.
You have no worries along those lines.
Not
whatsoever.
At all. They wouldn't harm you
totally,
at all.
All
they're interested in is the insects, really.
Exactly. I was going to ask something. If you have 700 bats here and they're eating something like 1,000 insects a night, they must be wiping out all the midges in the area.
Well, you'd like to think so, but as again, because we're surrounded by trees, we would have a good few midges.
Yeah, but yeah. We don't have moths. We don't have that stuff. And when they are here, we don't have that. We could leave on all them lights. We don't have them come into the house. The moths are on like that. So yeah. They are doing something like that. Or, you know, they're getting to the insects. They're getting to the insects.
The kids to be amazed, and we do have like bat counting parties here, and we'd sit out, and you know, you'd sit out, have a barbecue, and we'd all sit there at 9 o'clock, and we'd be counting the bats, how many bats are leaving the roost, you know. And it's a competition between our house and the property across the road, who also had an issue with bats as to who has the most, but we've won year on year.
Always. You're up now to 700 plus.
727 at last count, yeah.
It's just like the aeroplane, the 727.
Exactly.
Can you hear them? Because at my age now, I can't hear them unless I'm using a detector. I'm sure that the kids can hear it, but can you hear them?
Oh, you can hear them clearly.
Before they come out, you'll hear this high-pitched sound.
Will you, yeah?
Yeah, you'll hear from... Each one will make this high-pitched and then it'll just come out. And then you'll know there's more coming behind them, a high-pitched sound.
Yeah.
You'll know, you can't mistake it. You'll hear it. If you were standing there and they were coming out around 9 or half 9, you'd hear it. No bother at all.
They queue up. It's almost like they're in a queue to get out.
It's like
they're getting really excited, you know.
Your holidays.
Absolutely, and they're getting all excited just before they leave the roost. And you'll hear them, and you know when the noise starts to die down that you're nearly at the end of them.
Yeah.
You know that they've nearly, but people think that bats go and they don't come back. But as Shay said, they're in and out all night long.
They don't just go out at 9 o'clock at night.
They're in and out all night long, right. Because the shifts I work and as Shay was saying, we'd be out late at night. And when I'm leaving to go to work at 5:15 in the morning, you'd see them coming in and out and in and out. So they enter and exit from the same point.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean?
And with hundreds of them, do they ever crash?
No, I've never.
You've never seen
one on the ground. Never seen one anywhere around here. Never.
No.
Anywhere. You can see at night time when you come out, they'd be flying around, hundreds of them flying around, and they'd be missing each other completely. Yeah. Just Wonderful sight.
They really go so fast.
As you said earlier on, you're in a lovely spot here in the country. You've got lots of wildlife.
Yes.
And you have the bats, which most people don't have.
Yeah.
And you don't want to get rid of them.
No, we don't want to get rid of them by any manner of means. No. We want to protect them because, you know, it's your heritage, isn't it? It's your wildlife. So we just want them not to be in our attic, really.
Right.
And we need to insulate our house. So we can't do that without disturbing the bats. And we would prefer to do it safely and humanely, as in build the bat box. Shay, is no problem building bat boxes.
But if they're a breeding colony, you don't want to interrupt that header. You know, I want to find out what can we do.
Yes.
That's exactly what we want to know.
And they are a protected species.
Yes.
Nobody is allowed to touch them.
That's
Nobody's
right.
allowed to touch their roost and that. And that is certainly not your intention.
No, not at all.
But you would like something done.
We would. We would like, I suppose, a response.
Advice, really.
And anything. You know, anyone that would be able to come and have a look and, you know, physically see what we're dealing with. Because it's all well and good saying this is X, Y and Z. But when you actually see the amount of guanas you've seen on our gable end, and you could multiply that by 10 in our attic. You know what I mean? So you can't store anything at all. So we would really like to be able to preserve them and mind their roost and allow them to come back year on year and have their babies and go on ahead again. Because it's about preserving things, and it keeps the circle of life going in nature and keeps down the insects as well, do you know?
Now, I believe we've also been in touch with the National Parks and Wildlife Service.
Yes, we caught up with Dr. Ferdy Marnell, National Parks and Wildlife Service mammal specialist, with a particular interest in bat conservation. And this is what he had to say.
It's great to hear the people that Terry was interviewing there had a very positive attitude to bats. But occasionally problems do arise. And the first port of call is always the local conservation ranger. And rangers will always come out for free and look at people's individual situations and try and talk them through the problems and then the potential solutions. The second step that our rangers would normally take then is to just examine the particular problems in a particular case. So I'm not going to talk about any particular case, but typically issues such as maybe smell or bats flying around in the living space of the house. Occasionally you'd have young animals at the end of the summer when they're learning to fly in the attics will sometimes fall down through cracks around pipes and end up in hot presses. So, I mean, there's very simple and very common problems for which there are very straightforward solutions. And normally our rangers would be able to talk those solutions over with the homeowner. And by and large, most of the situations that we find ourselves in are resolved at that stage. I mean, if the straightforward solutions don't work, there is a legal route that can be taken as a final course, which involves a license being issued. But licences can only be issued by the minister for very specific reasons.
If homeowners simply board up their attics to prevent the bats returning, what impact does that have on them?
Unfortunately, there can be very negative consequences, particularly about the timing of such works. I mean, so bat roosts are protected, so it would be illegal to deliberately exclude bats. One of the problems that we have had previously, although not in recent years, thankfully, due to growing awareness, is that you can end up with the baby bats, the young pups, being entombed or confined to the attic and dying there, of course, because they can't fly until the end of the summer. They need to be weaned by the mothers before they're ready to leave the roost, and they're completely dependent on the mothers. So if the mothers are excluded and the babies are left in the attic, then they will die. And that doesn't lead to a pleasant outcome for anybody.
And you have a leaflet people can get hold of containing all of this information.
Yeah, so we have this leaflet, Bats in Houses, which would give background information on the ecology and distribution of bats in Ireland, but also goes into practical steps in terms of living with bats, issues such as, you know, if you need to do repairs or refurbishment or insulation works, what are the sort of the steps that you need to take to make sure that you don't break the law? And then it tries to address sort of the typical common concerns that people might have about bats.
Ferdy Marnell from the National Parks and Wildlife Service ending that report. That's all we have time for today. Visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild, celebrating 25 years on RTE Radio 1.